would like to welcome to Radio Gorgeous Madeline Rice, author of Before We Say Goodbye. And it is just about Mother's Day here in England. And I think the book is apt for that reason. It is my tearjerker of the season. Could you introduce us to the story of Before We Say Goodbye?
Before We Say Goodbye is a book about a boy who is dying, in effect. He's had a heart transplant when he was a boy, and his heart is failing now at the age of 19. And his mother has spent her life looking after him, worrying about him, and hasn't really focused much on herself. So, knowing that the days are running out, he wants to find her a partner, someone to love when he's not there. So that's his quest.
Because while his heart is physically frail, both their hearts, in an emotional sense, are as strong as they come. And she's used to being a fighting mama bear. She's been alone as his mother, as the mother of a sick boy. She's been his advocate. And she sort of doesn't know how else to be.
No, she... the father of the main protagonist, Scott, left when she was pregnant. So since then, she hasn't really had any sort of long-term relationships. And she is a kind of cerebral, inward-looking person anyway, and a bit prickly and a bit tricky. So I suppose that combined with the fact that her focus has always been on Scott, the dying boy, means that, yes, she has neglected herself in a sense. Which is why he knows that, and he cares and worries about her.
And so he sets out, how does he go about this project of getting mother a love?
Not in probably the most practical of ways, but he went through the options. She's not very technological, and so he figured, he knew she would be resistant to the concept of dating.
Well, most middle-aged women like us would be a bit resistant if our son said, you know, Mom, I'm going to find... I think just generally...
Yes, I think you're right.
So on a general and a general idea, bad. Two, she is, as you say, of the prickly variety. She has been alone. She's accustomed to it. She's used to... you know, him first, and in whatever free time she has, she wants to dig up fossils and pretty much, you know, work, and that's it, you know?
Yeah.
You know, her time's her own. So, yes, she's extra tricky.
So he thinks, as, you know, perhaps not the first thing to spring to one's mind, he thinks he'll put a film on YouTube asking people to come forward as candidates for her. So, and he's not expecting much at first. He just makes a little movie and sticks it on there. And then he starts having all sorts of responses from all sorts of people from all over the world, some of whom are more suitable than others.
Yes. And you do include, in the structure of the book, and it's one of those things. It's not as though we don't know what's going to happen. I mean, it's sort of very clear. He's had a heart transplant. Anything that's going to be more invasive, literally his heart's not in it. He's come to an accommodation that she can't find for him. But at the same time, I did find it quite suspenseful in a weird way.
Did you? I'm glad.
Because obviously we're hoping against hope for miracles ourselves, always.
Yes.
It's how we sustain ourselves, generally. But in the structure of the book, you include some of the communications from people who have seen this video. And respond to her. Tell me why you did that.
I'm quite interested in kind of little snapshots into people's lives. I think it's a kind of, it's an interesting way of breaking things up. Also, I'm a terrible plotter, and if I can have anything that will kind of carry me through from chapter to chapter, I hang on to it. And so it provided a little bit of structure to have these messages from, you know, people as random as, you know, someone who once likes fossils, or someone who collects pottery in a Sina vase on the movie that he thinks that she might want to give him, you know. So the weird and wonderful that might respond in such a situation.
And I found that very... I don't know if you know the performer Ursula Martinez.
No,
but
I don't.
She used to perform this very magical striptease, where she had a little red pocket square, which would, as she removed her clothes, was the only thing left. It kept moving around into the only pockets that were there, and then she was left with nothing but a very magical little pocket. And it was
the best pocket of all.
And it was meant to be a live performance, and she never had filmed it. She'd been offered to film. Well, she was at a festival, and it got filmed, and of course somebody released it. And she woke up one morning to 4,000 emails.
Oh, gosh.
And these were so reminiscent of... And she did a show called My Stories, Your Emails, of all these incredibly lonely...
Yes.
...people, some lovely, some weird, some wildly inappropriate, some, you know, off the wall, some, you know, just... But lonely people reaching out...
Yes.
And it does seem so silly that, you know, we all do want that, and yet it seems to elude so many of us as well.
Well, I suppose, yes, it does elude a lot of us. It's always a leap of faith. It's always a shot in the dark. You know, you just have to go for it, and if it doesn't work, you have to go for it again. Or maybe you might decide you've had enough and not go for it at all anymore. But, yes, we all want it. And I think there are lots of lonely people sitting at home hoping for a miracle of one sort or another.
And to have an advocate like Scott on your behalf, I guess, is a good thing.
Well, you know, teenage boys have that thing, don't they? They're kind of, they're black and white quite often. You know, it's things right and wrong, good person,
always
bad person.
And never,
yes.
Very judgmental.
They can be, hugely. But I think the thing about Scott is that he's got that thing that very sick children, I've noticed in sick children before, of a kind of acceptance about what's on offer for him now. And it's I don't know what it is. It's not a resignation exactly. It's a kind of peacefulness that I've seen mainly children actually have seemed to have it. Maybe because they don't know what they're going to miss. Maybe they don't have a sense of, you know, what the future might hold for them. So death hasn't quite got the grip. I don't know, but I have noticed it before.
Well, in his life, his early life has been so medicalized.
Yeah.
So that his purview is somewhat narrower than, say, his mother's before him. But he, you know, there is a lot of love. And as you say... doomed or not, and I think we all know, you know, our loves will end as mothers, as wives, as friends. It's always going to end. Because we, you know, so you may as well do it.
Yes.
If being hurt,
what have you got
ended,
to lose?
Exactly. Yes, and you will lose it. So what? So,
yes. Okay.
So have some. You know?
Yes.
Anyway, so where did the idea for this particular story come to?
It's always odd, isn't it? It's always hard to say where ideas come from. I did see a video on YouTube of a boy looking for a boyfriend for his mother. He's very different to my boy, and the story of his video, he's done subsequent videos, the real person, has ended, I think, very differently and was done for different motives. But I think the spark of the idea came from that. I thought, oh gosh, well, maybe I could think of a boy who was doing that, but was doing it with a higher stake in a way, And so that's where it started from.
Mm.
And then it's sort of spiraled out of control, as usual.
And what's sort of not commented on in the book, but I always find interesting, more especially, and maybe this is stereotypical in my thinking, or maybe it's sexist in my thinking, or maybe it's true, but that boys or children, but boys tend to see their mothers sort of very differently than perhaps they see themselves.
Sorry, I don't understand that. The boys see themselves...
No, see their mothers
differently
than
their mothers do.
Oh,
I see.
Yes.
Yes, I mean, that's difficult to sort of comment on. I have two boys, and I don't know, yes. I mean, I asked my younger one, who isn't very young now, he's at university, you know, what was... You know, I'm a terribly vain and needy person. And I said, you know, how would you describe me in one word? And I was kind of thinking he might say loving or...
In my face.
Yeah, you know, just kind of, I don't know, what, some sort of emotional thing. And he just thought for quite a long time and he just said, talented. And I was utterly crushed because he'd said about my husband, what did he say? Kind. He said very kind about my husband, his father. But I felt really kind of, yes, I would have wanted something else from him. I mean, you know, I'm sure he loves me and all the rest of it. But yes, I think boys see their mothers in a specific way, and it probably is very different to how you see yourself.
And that's I have to be absolutely thrilled of my
would you oh would you
that.
Well, maybe I should have been.
Well, and do you think, what do you think in particular he was referring to, your writing talent?
I guess so, but I think I've always sort of pretended to know more than I do. So, you know, whereas his father doesn't. So maybe he's got some idea.
Well, he didn't say show off.
He didn't say show off.
Or know it all.
He might have done.
Hyphenated. Technically, that's the one word. But I think it's interesting because you didn't come to writing.
No.
You know, you weren't always a writer in his life.
No.
So tell me why, because your father was very famous and... also talented.
Yes, very
writer,
talented.
Barry Unsworth. And you said that that was the thing that made you think, no, I'm not going to write ever.
Yes, I think it's funny having a parent who is very successful at what they do. It's both an inspiration and an inhibition, I think. I mean, I wrote as a journalist for years and years, and certainly as children, I mean, my parents' idea of fun was to send us out to go and write 3 pages on the inside of a ping pong ball or the underside of a leaf or something. That was their idea.
I think you could have stopped at my parents' idea of fun was sending us out.
Yes, I think that was the main thing. It wasn't to teach us the fine nuances of language. It was to get rid of us, in fact. But I mean, writing was always there. I have a sister who writes. In fact, all 3 of our sisters write. My third, the younger sister, writes drama books. And the middle sister writes children's books. And so, you know, with my father as well, it was inevitable. But I did fight it. I thought, there's so many books published every year, 250,000 or something, more maybe. You know, what possibly could I add to the sort of towering, you know, inferno of books, really. And I knew I'd never be as good as him, and that was my worry, because he was very, very good. I, you know, I'm proud and of what he achieved as a writer, and I have always been full of admiration. So that was inhibiting.
Yeah.
But we also got an idea when we were children that writing was somehow morally better than anything else you could do. Which is quite wrong, of course. But, you know, there was a sense that my father, we had to be quiet, and that what he did behind the closed doors of his study was very, very important. It would have, you know, as I got older, I realised I'd have preferred a doctor or a lawyer who could, you know, pay for nice holidays. We used to end up in houses at the tops of hills without toilets and things like that. So, yeah. So I think I resisted it. And then I think I, well, it came about because my mother sort of insisted and said she'd seen a television competition. And she said, all you need is three chapters. And I said, well, I haven't got three chapters and I don't want to write a book. And she literally bugged me to death. And so I had some notes that of something I'd started ages ago, the only thing I'd ever written in terms of fiction, and sort of got them into shape, sent them off, thought nothing more of it. And then got a letter saying you've got to come to the studio and be in the first round, and got through that, and then next thing I know, I'm sitting on a tricked-up polystyrene book, you know, like a hefty elf sitting on a sort of fake library set with plastic golden rain falling, and I got a publishing contract. And so I had three chapters and a publishing contract, and I thought, oh no, you know.
Now what?
Now what? So I wrote that in the end, or struggled on with it. And I think in the process of that, I realised, although part of me felt a little ashamed that I wasn't as good as my father, I also realised that there are all sorts of books and all sorts of readers, and that if I tried to be as good as I could be, then there was no shame in that. So that's what I've tried to do.
You sort of had to give yourself permission.
Yes. So it was kind of fate and permission and
bullying by your mother.
And my mother, who never gives up at all, ever.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
And so after that, did you say, oh, right. Did it feel more comfortable? Did you feel like, you know, because you didn't go back to, you could have said, okay, fine, you know, that was fun, that was cute, that was great, and now I'll go back to doing journalism, and, you know, that's a more comfortable fit for me, but you didn't.
No, I know, that's interesting. It's a very good question, why I didn't stop then.
You could have gotten out.
I had this strange sense then that I wanted to be in the club, you know? And I got kind of mournful when I went into bookshops and thought, oh, I won't be in this club anymore. It was a bit shallow, I suppose. But I found I actually do enjoy it as well. I enjoy those. It's great to be able to sit at your desk. I mean, I work 2 days a week elsewhere. I work at a brain injury charity 2 days a week, and I think it's really important for writers to do other things, whether they're great writers or not. I think, you know, hearing people's voices and just
getting your head out of your own
bottom
stuff.
Yes.
shifting one's body. Yes,
yeah.
Exactly.
I discovered I actually really enjoyed doing it.
Well, and we really enjoy reading it.
Thank you.
Thank you so much, Madeline Rice.
It's my pleasure.
Happy Mother's Day.
Oh, thanks.